Hello and welcome back to the quarterly Kier Marbach podcast, episode 2. The goal for today's podcast is to discuss the recovery of the economy throughout the pandemic and how it relates to the markets and investing overall. We will also spend some time on a couple common questions we have been hearing from our clients, mainly around low interest rate environment and the upcoming election. To help us explain these concepts, we're joined by Kier Marbach's Chief Investment Officer, Mark Foster. Welcome back, Mark.
Thanks, Zach.
As well as Kier Marbach's Senior Research Analyst, Roger Lee. Thanks for joining us, Roger.
Thanks, Zach.
All right, gentlemen, let's dive in. Mickey recently wrote a great article in the Indianapolis Business Journal discussing the K-curve recovery. Anyone interested in reading the full article can easily find it on our website at kiermar.com on the Insights tab. Mark, can you give us a quick explanation of the K-curve recovery?
Sure. If you draw the letter K on a piece of paper, uppercase or lowercase, doesn't really matter. It's a great visualization for the current state of our economy at every level, from local to national, even international. And the same applies to the stock market indices. The upper right leg of the K represents the beneficiaries of the pandemic, and the lower right leg of the K represents those negatively affected by the pandemic.
I see. That makes sense. Can you give a little color on how this applies locally?
Yeah, when we drive around Columbus and observe retail traffic and parking lots, we see many businesses that are doing better than they would be in normal times, while we also see businesses that are either closed or struggling to stay afloat. For example, you'll notice home improvement stores are very busy, while the movie theaters are not. If you look at restaurant traffic, many of our independent sit-down restaurants downtown have seen significant declines in traffic, while our big chain fast food drive-through lines get longer and longer.
Boy, I couldn't agree more. I think you've summed up my past 6 months perfectly. I can tell you that I have a honey-do list that I feel like is keeping the home improvement stores in business. And at the same time, can't remember the last time we were able to go out to a movie or a date night event. You know, talking about eating out, I've been too more than a guilty of sitting in a certain two-lane drive-through, and I know we cannot wait to be able to visit some of our local favorite spots again.
Absolutely. E-commerce has been a disruptive force in retail for the last decade at the expense of brick-and-mortar stores. With shutdowns earlier in the year and ongoing reservations about going to physical stores today, consumers have really changed how they choose to purchase many of their goods. Amazon has made it very convenient to have virtually any household item delivered to your door in a day or two. The pandemic has accelerated the shift for many households to buy more goods online, and the convenience is addictive. In this prior example, the big online retailers are the upper leg of the K, while the brick and mortar retailers and independents are the lower leg of the K.
We can also dig into the local real estate market to see how retail is changing. The last few years, we watched the decline of a big old school shopping mall in Columbus, and this is happening nationwide from big shopping malls to strip malls. At the same time, we keep seeing new fulfillment centers along I-65 between Indy and Louisville. People used to shop in stores. Then they started buying stuff online, and now with COVID, they buy even more stuff online. Instead of inventory sitting on shelves, it goes straight from distribution centers to doorsteps. The same shift put Blockbuster in bankruptcy 10 years ago, and now most of us are streaming our movies online.
You know, as we talk to our clients, they've been asking about the disconnect between the stock market highs and the underlying fundamentals from our economy. Things like record unemployment, 30% decline in consumer spending in the second quarter. You know, just generally getting back to normal activity. With the S&P back at all-time highs, talk us through this disconnect and how it looks to play out in 2021.
Certainly back in March or early April, the prospect of new highs in the market seemed pretty remote. But you've had several things happen that have significantly improved the picture. First, the Federal Reserve provided massive liquidity. This not only lowered interest rates, but provided access to anyone needing to borrow. This took the prospect of a credit crunch and subsequent large bankruptcies off the table. Second, the market is seeing an earnings recovery and is looking towards 2021 for an even better recovery. Remember, the market looks 12 months forward, not what's happening now. Managements have done a good job of quickly taking costs out of their business, so for most companies, 2021 earnings will get back to or exceed where they were in 2019. In addition, the stay-at-home orders have been very good for many tech companies' fundamentals, and they have actually seen earnings move higher through all of this. Combine those together, and we currently have 2021 consensus estimates that are 6 or 7% higher than 2019. So it's really not that illogical that the market has traded as well as it has, as investors have begun to focus on 2021 and have gained confidence in the reopening of the economy. This reopening is really the key. We have to find a way to balance the health risks with the economic risks. I think we've discovered that a total economic shutdown is too blunt and ineffective, and policymakers seem to be shifting to smart lockdowns or local restrictions. We are seeing good signs from the economy. U.S. home sales were up almost 9% in August. Strong job adds in September. Leading indicators are recovering. China and other international markets are also recovering. If that continues, the bottom leg of the K curve will begin to respond. And if not, the market will continue to be driven by big tech and COVID beneficiaries.
To switch gears a little bit, earlier you talked about the Federal Reserve providing liquidity, causing low interest rates. At the same time, we've also heard comments from Fed Chair Powell about the outlook of keeping rates low for the foreseeable future. My question to you, Roger, is how does low interest rates affect stocks?
Stop me if I get too academic. The simple answer is that low interest rates make stocks more attractive because they make bonds less attractive. If you buy bonds when interest rates are low like they are today, you're locking in a low return for the duration of that bond or until you sell it. Now, if you look out a few years when inflation picks up, the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates to slow down inflation. At that point in time, the value of lower yielding bonds will go down because people will expect higher yields. We can put this in better perspective with U.S. Treasuries. If you were to buy a 10-year bond from the U.S. government today, you'd earn less than 0.8% per year. For each $100 of bonds you buy, you get paid under 80 cents per year. Stretch that out to 30 years, and you'd earn just over 1.5% per year. In this case, for every $100 of government bonds you buy, you'd get paid $1.50 each year. If you expect inflation of 2% in the long term, you are actually losing wealth by buying bonds at today's risk-free rates. In theory, if you buy $100 of 30-year government bonds today, you will lose 50 cents each year in purchasing power. This is happening all over the world. Less than a year ago, the German government actually issued bonds with negative interest rates, which means those investors were paying the government to hold their money. Going back to stocks, if the Fed keeps interest rates low and inflation is expected to go over 2%, stocks are very attractive. Current inflation is 1.3%, and it'll probably go over 2% from government stimulus, with round two on the way. If bonds don't pay much and the value of your money is going down with inflation, stocks and real estate are a good place to store wealth because they typically go up with inflation. If we get real academic for a minute, companies raise prices with inflation and corporate earnings grow with inflation. When earnings go up, stocks go up. Tying it all back to the Fed, we expect low interest rates for the next few years and inflation over 2%. Citing Fed Chairman Powell from last month, we think that the economy is going to need low interest rates, which support economic activity for an extended period of time. However long it takes, we're going to be there. We're not going to prematurely withdraw the support that we think the economy needs.
Talk me through how this affects households. And I guess also, how does it intersect with other stimulus measures?
If we take this from Wall Street to Main Street, general home prices are doing well. Lower interest rates are making mortgages more affordable and increasing the demand for homes. With 30-year mortgages readily available under 3% last quarter, buyers are driving up prices. Higher home prices increase wealth for homeowners who can refinance or get a HELOC. Households also benefited from stimulus checks and unemployment boosts, which they are spending. If you look at used car lots or used car prices, used car salesmen are having a great 2020.
You know, don't fight the Fed is certainly one of the phrases we have heard over the years. And I know that's a key ingredient you have talked about internally and on checklist of things you look for in a healthy market. Given the many cross currents today, perhaps it would be helpful, Mark, to share some of those key items with our listeners.
Well, there's certainly lots of issues to deal with today, but I think it's important to keep in mind that historically, there have always been issues. Recessions, wars, elections, high interest rates, there's always something to worry about. But over the years, we have found that rising markets typically do contain certain key fundamentals. Let's start with inflation. Inflation and forward expectations drive Fed policy. As Roger discussed, the Fed has given the all clear that they are committed to economic recovery and will do whatever it takes to make that happen and are not concerned about inflation. So this positive Fed stance drives money availability, money supply, excess liquidity, easing financial conditions. These should all drive the economy to recover from the COVID-19 recession, just as it has in prior recessions. Money availability drives the economy, and the economy drives earnings growth. Historically, there's a 90% correlation between the direction of earnings and the direction of stock prices. Earnings go up, stocks go up. Earnings go down, stocks go down. In terms of earnings, we were positively surprised that many companies in the portfolio generated better second quarter earnings than we expected, some significantly better. We will get a further update on third quarter earnings over the next few weeks.
So in summary, what does all this mean for client portfolios? As we've noticed, the investment team has been pretty active thus far this year.
Yeah, we've been a little more active than normal. We used the market weakness earlier in the year to add larger, more dominant companies to the portfolio. We focused on companies with higher growth profiles and less volatile businesses that can withstand any economic environment, including a pandemic. We are still sensitive to valuation, but we've always used periods of market weakness to upgrade the portfolio. Currently, the average market capitalization, or the size of the company in the portfolio, is now 3 times larger than it was at the end of 2019 and is approaching $55 billion. So for comparison purposes, this is almost 2 times larger than locally based Cummins Inc.
All right. Obviously, we couldn't get through this podcast without touching on the most important topic to a lot of our clients, the election. Any thoughts on the election and comments on how you've positioned portfolios ahead of November?
Well, we don't position the portfolios around elections because it's really unknowable with any confidence. The 2016 election certainly caught the market by surprise. However, we're very cognizant of binary risks. We have chosen to avoid stocks with a high degree of regulatory risk in election years, such as stocks that might be affected by changes in the Affordable Care Act. I will share a couple election-related fun facts. From 1937 to 2019, annualized market returns, when there has been a divided government, have averaged 1.5% higher than when the government was united. A divided government being Congress and the president are different, a united government being when they're of the same party. So being divided and making fewer changes is better. Similarly, when Congress was in session, S&P 500 returns averaged 0.7%, and when Congress was out of session, annualized returns were 16.6%. Businesses are pretty good at adapting once they know the rules. If the rules keep changing and creating uncertainty, that's when investors get nervous.
Funny how when Congress is out of session, we all do better. I'm sorry, I just couldn't help myself. Mark, Roger, this was very insightful. Thanks for taking the time to talk through these complex issues. Picturing a K when talking about the recovery really helps me visualize it. I look forward to sitting down with you guys again first of next year. Hopefully by then we have a clearer picture on the virus vaccines and the general reopening. And jokingly, most importantly, a president picked. Thanks for listening. Look forward to catching up with you guys next quarter.